Accession number 20895, Real Fool.
However, we still had to take the dinghies onto the bridge and dump them in that vicinity. Nothing of great interest in the move up the bridge. We were really following a line of green berries, and we were not ourselves involved in any aggressive action, nor on the receipt of anything except the moaning minis, which were dropped on us from time to time, but they were astride the line along which we were moving, and because the ground was so soft, they did no real damage. We began to meet German prisoners being hustled back towards the beach by walking wounded from 6th Commando, who had been leading the advance, and of course dead bodies here and there, but nothing of great drama. Arriving at the bridge, we were warned by somebody in the airborne that the bridges, the bridge first of all over the canal and then over the Orne River, were under fire, mainly from the Berneville Chateau de Berneville, I think, which was some 200 or 300 or 400 yards upriver from us. I gladly saw our dinghies dumped and then told my men to run across in groups of 2 or 3 at a time and to run across the bridges. I decided to wait till the end with Jock Irvin and with Sergeant Hepper. We set off, and at some point Hepper was hit in the neck. I wasn't conscious of being fired. I don't remember any bullets cracking past me, but Bob Hepper was certainly hit in the neck, and we left him in charge of the airborne medics there, and he survived. I then went on to join up with Ian Beadle and the rest of E Troop. Ian told me that Charles Rees, the CO, had been wounded, and that Nicol Gray, the second commander, had taken over the command of the commando. We then set off, moving along the road from what is now known as Pegasus Bridge, towards Salonel, in the direction of Merville and Franceville. We were led by C Troop, which was the commando's cycle troop. Each of the commanders in the brigade had a cycle troop. And this was a peaceful interlude, if you like. We merely moved along the road, leaving Pegasus Bridge, I should think, at about perhaps 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the afternoon. We reached Salonel, and the order of march in the commando was the cycle troop, which was Charlie Troop, led by Jock Rushforth, leading, followed by A Troop. Then came the CO, now Nicol Gray, with his remaining O Group, orders group, in other words, the troop commanders of the other three troops, and his adjutant. The IO had been killed on landing, so we'd lost the IO and the CO. As we moved through Salonel, the leading troop, C Troop, followed by A Troop right on their heels, turned off the road and moved up to the right on a track which would lead them to the Merville Battery. This was correct and as planned. But the CO's group, which was following immediately behind them, did not notice this and so continued on the road which led them outside, beyond Salonel, on the road to Franceville. We following, I was then, with Ian Beadle, with the CO, I was then leading E Troop with the remainder B and D following behind me. But their troop commanders were all forward with the CO. And then, about 200 yards outside Salonel, I heard small arms fire ahead of me and saw the CO's group scatter off the road. I brought E Troop to a halt, and as we were completely open in that particular area, with no cover on the seaward side, which is from where I could gather the enemy fire came, I moved them back about 50 yards where they were covered by a group of trees, set up a machine gun, a Bren gun, to cover a pillbox, and in case there was any action from that pillbox, which I could see about 300 yards away. The firing ahead ceased, nothing seemed to be happening, so I thought I'd better go forward and see what was going on. So leaving Ted Cage with the troop sergeant major in charge of the rest of the troop, I moved up on my own, thinking I was going to be walking 100, 200 yards to where the Sears group was. But I'd gone only about 100 yards out of cover of the trees when I became the centre of a lot of unpleasant attention. As on the seaward side, it was on my left, there was absolutely no cover at all. On the right, there was a ditch and a little bank with a fence on it and then trees. So I moved swiftly across the road, hurled myself at the fence, got caught in it, my rucksack got caught in it. The whip crack of bullets were too close to take a second try, so I just dropped down into the ditch and crawled rather uncomfortably some 50 or 60 yards back to the rest of my troop. Very soon after this, the Sears group made their way across country without any further fire coming on them, and I got the word from behind me to withdraw and then follow the rest of the commando up the path which C and A troops had already followed. There had been a few casualties in this little bit of nonsense with the enemy. We lost the IO, we lost the CO, we now lost the signals officer, and some others as well. We arrived at Merville without any further interference. What I didn't in fact know at the time, but I heard later, was that the CO and the leading troop commander, Jock Rushforth from C Troop, were doing a reconnaissance prior to attacking the battery, which we knew was occupied because one of its guns was firing, presumably, in the direction of the beach. But then the CO received a signal to say that he was to not proceed any further, not to attack the battery, but to hold Merville. And so this was the order I next received in E Troop, and we took up a defensive position in the village of Merville. Nothing of great importance happened that night except the pleasure of seeing a mass of gliders flying in over the coast and dropping, as we knew, in the area of Romville, some 6, 7, 8 miles away from us, a very welcome reinforcement. We heard some bombing that night, but that was in the area of the bridgehead and nothing in our own direction. About 3 or 4 o'clock, I think, next morning, the commando received a signal to withdraw to join up with the rest of the brigade in the area which we knew as Le Plain, a ridge which overlooked the Orne Valley and would provide the left-hand flank of the whole Allied landing. We withdrew just about as day was breaking, retracing the route through Salonelle we'd followed the previous day, and I remember seeing an unexploded shell on the road on the western side of Salonelle, obviously a naval shell. And then took up a position near a hamlet called Auger, H-A-U-G-E-R, where 4 commando were in position. We were in a sort of orchard on a hill, with, as far as I remember, in E troop, very little in the way of a field of fire in front of us. I spent such little time as we were there going around the other troops trying to find a key for the Vickers K gun, which each troop carried. Unfortunately, it required a special key to load the magazine, and the chap carrying the gun had dropped, lost the key during the landing, but I was unsuccessful in getting a spare key. When I returned to E Troop, the CO had called an O Group, and it was clear from what I heard from this that we were going to be on the move shortly, returning to Merville, and then moving, as we should have done earlier on D-Day, to attack the sea defences at Franceville Plage. We are because the battery, we know the battery was had been reoccupied by the Germans, two troops from 3 Commando were to come under Nicol Gray so that they could deal with the battery and prevent that group of Germans from interfering with our advance on Franceville. So we duly set forth summer, I should think, probably about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, going back the same way we had advanced the day before, through Salonel, which was now under what at the time seemed to be a heavy bombardment, but from later experience I realised was just an unpleasant one. It seemed to be a little asking for trouble to actually advance into a bombardment, which was what we were doing. But we got through it with very few casualties, but those that were caused were unfortunate ones and important ones. The mortar section was badly hit, and although not becoming casualties, the signallers carrying the brigade signal set decided to take a way around rather than through the village and became lost to the commando and had to return to brigade headquarters. So we lost our communications with brigade headquarters. However, we arrived at Merville, taking up roughly the positions we'd been in the night before, rather that early that morning, and then prepared for the advance on Franceville. This began as planned at 5 o'clock. The plan, very briefly, was for E and B troops to advance simultaneously either side of the main road through Franceville, which ran from the coast road to the sea, and which we gave the nickname Piccadilly. C troop were moved to the left of Franceville and take up a position on the outskirts of this small holiday village to prevent any enemy in the field, in the coast defences on that side, from interfering with the advance through Franceville. The remaining troops, D and A, were to enter Franceville shortly after the initial advance. So we set off, cheerfully enough, down the hill from Merville, which was pretty open ground, but without exciting any interest from the enemy. We had actually called, it had been a pre-planned naval bombardment of the enemy defences on the shore and also on the God, I always get this wrong. On the eastern side of Franceville. This had been pre-planned, and these bombardments took place before we began our advance. We had with us a bombardment officer who had communications to the bombarding ships. He, once we began our move forward, or perhaps shortly before that, having arranged this pre-planned bombardment, he moved to a German OP position near Salonel, which was up a tree, and as I found out many years later, but not at the time, chasing a German sniper away from there damaged his radio set, so That explained why we lost radio contact with him. We'd lost contact with him, we had lost contact with brigade headquarters, so we had no means of calling for any support whatsoever. Off we went into Franceville. As far as E Troop was concerned, it was a matter, we moved to through the backs of houses on the main street. These were all, many of them were shuttered, they were all empty, there wasn't a sign of life as far as we were concerned in E Troop, neither French nor German. And we moved up to a position at the far C end of the main street, but off the main street, some 50 yards off. Here we stopped in a garden of a house which was on a little mound, and although most of the houses were divided from each other with hedges, this had a wall on the seaward side in which was an archway. There may well have been a door at some stage, but when we were there, there was an archway, no sign of a door. Here, Ian Beadle assembled the troop in a quick all-round position and said that he was going to take the Piat group. This is this little clumsy, awkward weapon which was designed to fire bombs at tanks for the range of about 50 to 80 yards. He was going to take the Piat group and have a go to try and get a Piat projectile into the pillbox that was at the end, the seaward end of the main village road. And as he was talking, or as he was telling me what he was going to do, about 10 yards from this archway in the wall, a couple of mortar bombs dropped on the other side of the wall. I was hit in the arm and sent flat on my back, and Ian was hit somewhere in the face. I had, in fact, to go back a little bit now, he had, in fact, briefed me and was setting out going to go through the archway when I suddenly thought of something to ask him, called out to him and stopped him going through the archway, because I called him and he came back a few paces to meet me. It was then that the mortar bombs had fallen, and if I hadn't called out to him, he would have been right there when the mortar bombs fell. However, he dusted himself off. He did not appear to be badly wounded in the face, and my arm was bleeding, but not badly wounded, and off he went. I sat down, stripped off my blouse, while Irvin, my MOA, stuck a pad on my arm to stop the bleeding. And then shortly after that, I was joined by Piers Dunkley, a lieutenant from B Troop, with his section, who should have been the other side of the road, but he joined up with us and suggested that he should move off to the left flank, which is where the C Troop was. Piers and I had joined together. We were in the same batch, but I had passed out of the batch some 10 places up above Piers, who was a friend of mine. And I was by this time rather worried. I heard firing ahead where Ian Beadle was. I suppose my arm was aching, but I very sharply told Piers to join us and not to move on elsewhere. And Piers, being the good fellow he was, just said, "All right, Johnny," and proceeded to do what I required. Shortly after this, Ian Beadle appeared through the arch, or rather, Ted Cager, who'd been looking through the arch, called out to me, I don't know what he said, but then disappeared through the arch and then reappeared a second or two later, helping Ian Beadle, who was in turn helping, obviously, a wounded man and somebody else carrying the Piat. Ian explained that they had fired a shot with the Piat at the pillbox, which had landed short. Before they could do anything else, mortar bomb had landed near them, killed a chap called Lee, who was the Lance Corporal in charge of the group, and wounded another man. And so Ian then saw German infantry approaching him and decided the only thing to do was to get himself and his wounded man back with him. So there we were. Now, Ian and I then started discussing what we should do now, when there was a signal from Commander Headquarters telling us to withdraw to the road junction where the main road for the village met the coastal road, and to do that immediately. So we then collected ourselves together and started the withdrawal back to the RV point. We were mortared a little on the way back, and there were some exchanges of small arms fire, but the enemy never really looked like pressing close on us, and we were withdrawing. We were biting back, as it were, so they were perhaps wise not to press too closely. But we arrived back having, I think, suffered one man killed on the way back, two or three wounded, one of whom died by the time we got to the RV point. And there we found much of the rest of the commando assembling. We had been attacked from the right flank, which had caused considerable confusion to the two troops that had been placed there. And the enemy then began to close in on the crossroads behind us, as it were, on the landward side, looking as if they would cut us off from the rest of our withdrawal line to the brigade, or rather from our withdrawal line to the rest of the brigade. We'd been saved by C Troop doing a very spirited attack on buildings on the crossroads in which there were no holding. The pressure from the enemy now died down, and it must have been about 8 o'clock in the evening, or perhaps even later. There we were on a sandy knoll with buildings in front of us, very little shelter, very concentrated position, and very vulnerable to any enemy shell fire or mortar fire. I was asked to find a position for a Bren gun, which I found in a nearby house, having tried one way and nearly been cut off in my prime, but managed to fall back quickly before the walking into the enemy fire, who was obviously expecting me to emerge from a pile of long grass. But other than that, there was no great excitement. And as dusk came, Nickel Grey decided to withdraw, there being no future for us where we were. I'm not sure, but I have a feeling that we were cut off at this point from our commando medical post. But we had with us some 20 men who were too badly hit to be moved. And so the difficult decision was taken that they must be left behind when we withdrew to Merville. And volunteers were required amongst the medical orderlies who had with us to stay and look after these men and become prisoners with them. And one of the volunteers was our own Private Dunlop, who earlier had showed his spirit in becoming a parachutist against his wishes, because he now volunteered with another man to stay behind and look after the wounded. Piers Dunkley, my friend, was amongst them. He had been badly hit in the back, and I know from Piers, when I met him after the war, that the Germans had in fact treated our wounded very well and looked after them when they came upon them the next day. So we set forth back to Merville, each of us, each troop being to save any confusion, being told to take up the position they had held the previous night. And I do remember E Troop, because we were at the south western end of the commander position, we set off on our own. We followed a different route to the rest of the commando. And although my memory tells me I was the leading man as we withdrew. This is unlikely. I think there must have been one or two men in front of me. But I do remember this long and silent walk up to our position, waiting every second for a burst of machine gun fire to come down upon us. But nothing happened. We arrived back, took up our former positions without further incident. By now, we're talking now about the early hours of the 8th of June. We had no chance to replenish any supplies, either of ammunition or of food, and we were still some 3 or 4 miles from the brigade position, without any knowledge of what was happening in the intervening area. The early hours in our occupation of Merville were quiet. A message was received. I was told that a patrol had been sent back to brigade headquarters in order to obtain a radio set. I had earlier ordered the men who happened to be with me, some 10 or 15 men at the time, when we were approaching Merville, we had been fired upon, and thinking that we were going to get into a battle, I told them to dump their haversacks. This they had done. But I was quite wrong. We were not involved in a battle in Merville. That didn't happen until we went down to Franceville. And it was very rash of me to dump the haversacks, which contained, amongst other things, food and spare ammunition. And I was now being told by Nicol Gray if I thought I could find them. And I said I saw no reason not to be able to find them. So took a small patrol out, retrieved the rucksacks, which had not been touched by the enemy. But the patrol that had been sent off to brigade headquarters returned with a message that we were to hold on in Merville and that supplies and reinforcements would be sent to us later that morning. But hardly had they set up their station, to open up communications with brigade, when the signal received saying, regretfully unable to forward any reinforcements or supplies, and that Merville was to be held to the last man. The patrol getting there and back had quite a passage and exciting time, but they had done well to bring us the radios back. As far as E Troop is concerned, and that's really only troop that I knew what happened in that day, the rest I heard much later on. We had a fairly quiet morning, although we heard firing by troops in the other areas. We were not ourselves attacked early on, but later in the morning there was movement against us. We had a good position looking to the north over open ground, which we had passed ourselves on our way to Franceville. The enemy now had to pass on that ground, and enemy movement in that area was attacked by us. And held off. They never really looked like getting anything anywhere near an assaulting position. And that was a fairly minor outbreak early in the morning. But we were already beginning to get anxious about ammunition. I cannot now remember precise times, but there was another attack later in the day which was much more troublesome as far as we were concerned, though once again our position in the troop position was so secure with such good fields of fire that we were in no danger of being overrun. The situation was very different on the other side, the rest of the commander's position, and withdrawals had been made, particularly as the enemy had brought up self-propelled tanks and we had virtually run out of anti-tank missiles, and in fact ammunition all round was getting very short now. We were of course mortared from time to time, even though the infantry were not attacking us, and one occasion, and this is late in the afternoon, about 5 or 6 o'clock, by which time we had been told by brigade that we should, in view of our parlous state, running out of ammunition, etc., we should withdraw after dark. And this had been passed down to my level in the troop. And I was telling Irvin, who shared my slit trench with me, of this, and we were both totting up the remaining army.